This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good morning, everybody. Never a presentation these days without a PowerPoint. I would like to begin by acknowledging the Ngunnawal traditional owners of the Canberra region. And I'd also like to thank the conference conveners for generously inviting me to give this opening address. I would like to start with three vignettes. Vignette number one. On September 8 this year, I was in a committee room in Parliament House, accompanying a delegation of Yolngu and Binning from Western and Eastern Arnhem Land and their resource agency staff. They were passionately pleading with DIWA, that's the Department of Employment, and FACSIA, the Department of Housing, Community Services, Indigenous Affairs, bureaucrats and ministerial advisers for policies that were more supportive of our homelands and outstations, and in particular for the reinstatement of the CDP scheme. They were informed by concerned-looking but adamant bureaucrats that they share the same vision to close the gap, but that changes to CDP were non-negotiable. CDP reform, code for abolition, was now government policy that bureaucrats could only implement, not influence. The bureaucrats articulated the view that those on CDP would eventually be able to find proper jobs, in the case of the Yolngu at the mine in Gove. Perhaps people would need to move off country to find mainstream employment. The bureaucrats were repeatedly asked why Yolngu and Binning were being forced from work on CDP to passive welfare, a question that was never answered. The meeting ended with vague commitment to review employment possibilities in remote Arnhem Land to see what might be done. Vignette number two. 3 weeks later, I was in Eastern Arnhem Land at a moving Welcome to Country ceremony, a theatrical post-colonial event on Nullan, the sacred hill in the centre of the mining town of Nullumboy. A senior Rirratjungu man told us how his father, the late Roy Marika, had fought in the Balka and the Commonwealth to stop mining. Pointing at massive retention ponds clearly visible from the top of the hill and the expansive bauxite processing facility and port, he explained to us that the transformations that mining had caused to the landscape were the equivalent of scarring his body. He demonstrated this by running his fingers across his chest. He was the new head of the Dimaru Aboriginal Corporation, a community-based natural resource and cultural resource management agency established by the Yolngu to ameliorate environmental impacts in the Gove region. He explained that he could never work for the mining company that violated his land in direct transgression of his father's wishes, but the company did provide some funding to Dimaru. My third vignette. A week earlier, I'd been in Western Arnhem Land, attending the declaration of the Wadakan Indigenous Protected Area on the Arnhem Land escarpment. A senior landowner, describing himself as a fire ecologist, explained what emptying the landscape of people had meant in the contemporary period. Introduced feral animals and unmanaged wildfires had major destructive impacts on rock art sites, sacred billabongs, waterways, and on the viability of endemic species. The land had been orphaned and had suffered, but now it was being reoccupied. The land needed its people, and the declaration of the IPA with significant state support from DUHA, that's the Department of Environment, was seen as an opportunity to bring back the next generation onto country, to learn about country and species management from the old people before it was too late. He was adamant that people needed to be brought in to manage this country, to orbit in, not orbit out, and that Binning and Ballander, Indigenous and Western scientists, had to work together, collaboratively, on the challenging of managing the 13,000 square kilometres of Wadakan IPA, an area larger than small countries like Lebanon or Jamaica, but with a population of only several hundred people. These three vignettes encapsulate much of what I want to talk about this morning. They demonstrate three forms of development interaction. The first represents a humiliating rebuff by influential agents of the neoliberal state suggesting to Yulnu and Binning that they need to get proper jobs, including at mines that they opposed at Gove and Jabiru. A community employment program was to be dismantled to force people to take such real jobs. The second vignette provides a brief historical and cultural context for State and Yulnu crossed purposes in relation to such mainstream employment. And the third provides a segue to more productive and hybrid contemporary State-Binning relations, supported by more sympathetic elements of the bureaucratic field, to use Bourdieu's term, that advocates for Aboriginal management of regions of high biodiversity value. The vignettes demonstrate diversity in the neoliberal project of improvement, ranging from an inability to respond to Aboriginal aspirations and desires in the economic realm and an obstinate intent to reshape them, to a more sympathetic response that values Aboriginal contributions and ways of being. Let me turn now to the hybrid economy construct. In 2001, I devised the conceptual framework of the hybrid economy for my purposes, to help me understand a particular empirically grounded economic context and its transformations. I was particularly keen to transcend the oversimplified market-non-market binary in relation to Indigenous economies and to properly complexify what I was researching at that time. I was motivated in this endeavour by three things. The first was the inadequacy of my previous way of looking at outstation economies, focusing on the duality market and non-market, formal and informal, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, which grossly oversimplified the situation I was analysing. My earlier approach, based on structural functionalism, was useful for understanding historical transformations, but was of limited use for explaining the contemporary intercultural and the role of power relations with the Australian state. My earlier work was inadequate because while it recognised structure and agency, it underestimated the role of the state and under-theorised the processes of governmentality. The second motivation was the emergence of the discursive debate in Australia between progressives and conservatives as part of the history and now culture wars. Again, with the benefit of hindsight, I misunderstood this as an Australian debate rather than an Australian manifestation of the neoliberal ascendancy that has rapidly gathered global pace in the last decade. Third was my growing recognition of the inability of private capital and the state to deliver development opportunity in remote Australia, in large measure because of an unwillingness to properly invest in what, on economic rationalist grounds, using old economy lenses, appear to be unproductive regions. Always have to have the picture. The hybrid economy construct, as in this colourful diagram, is highly abstract, but it can readily be historically and empirically situated with reference to people, places, and practices. And while its focus is on productive relations, the model can readily accommodate distributive and consumptive relations as well. For example, individualism and market exchange in segment 3, domestic moral economy and customer exchange in segment 2. There are three crucial elements of the hybrid economy model: intersectoral dialectics, spatial flexibility, and temporal flexibility. In terms of the figure, people can seek livelihood in segments 4, 5, 6, and 7, not just in sectors 1, 2, or 3. In different places, everything in the diagram changes. And over time, not only can the diagram change, but people can occupationally migrate to any of niches 1 to 7. The hybrid economy framework properly complexifies contemporary Aboriginal economies in a way that is rarely understood by state or private interests, who, in keeping with Weberian theory, seek to monetize everything and turn a culturally informed blind eye to what happens in the non-monetized informal sector. Conversely, the model properly reflects the agency of Aboriginal economic actors as they make choices while pursuing a livelihood that can be conceptually placed in different sectors and overlapping segments of the model. Let me shift now to look at the issue of living remotely beyond the mainstream and the neoliberal project of improvement. In April this year, Australia belatedly endorsed the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I want to refer today to just two articles in the Declaration. Article 26, which states, Indigenous peoples have the right to the lands, territories and resources which they have traditionally owned, occupied or otherwise used or acquired. And Article 23, Indigenous peoples have the right to determine and develop priorities and strategies for exercising their right to development. Land rights and native title laws have seen considerable parts of remote Australia return to Aboriginal people. Today, over 20% of Australia is Aboriginal owned. Official government statistics indicate that about 100,000 Aboriginal people live in just over 1,000 Aboriginal communities on this land, with most, 988 communities, having a population of less than 100. In relation to Article 26, many Aboriginal traditional owners have been able to successfully reclaim their land. But land ownership is heavily skewed in favour of remote Australia and away from settled Australia, where land is more commercially productive, even today, and where Aboriginal people have been thoroughly dispossessed. However, even where Aboriginal people have seen property rights and land reinstated, property rights in commercially valuable resources, like minerals and water, have not been legally recognised. As a general rule, to get back to their land, Aboriginal claimants have to participate in a Western legal process that requires institutional codification of traditions and customs, what Patrick Wolfe has evocatively termed repressive authenticity. For example, Section 3 of the Aboriginal Land Rights Northern Territory Act requires that Aboriginal people demonstrate that they are a local descent group with primary spiritual affiliation for sacred sites, entitled as a right to forage over the land claimed. And Section 223 of the Native Title Act requires claimants to demonstrate continuity of rights and interests under traditional laws acknowledged and traditional customs observed, and the maintenance of connection with lands and waters since colonisation. Through these requirements, Indigenous Australians have become trapped in a Western legal definition of authenticity to gain formal title to their ancestral lands, and the onus is on them to prove this. When claims or determinations succeed, sometimes after years of legal contestation, it is hardly surprising that people want to live on country and engage, even if only sporadically, in customary economic activity in its own right or interlinked with other market or state-supported activity. Remote communities, all those dots in my overhead, and many more, because it's actually hard to get enough dots onto a figure like this, are clearly non-mainstream communities. There are post-colonial constructs resulting from fraught historical processes of invasion, land alienation, warfare, and incarceration. And yet the dominant discourse seeks to assess the viability of these communities according to some imagined assessment of cost-benefit, or input-output, or export-import, or public-private, that are not applied to non-Indigenous communities, large or small, in remote Australia. And while we have ongoing debates about economic viability and size, there is no evidence that I'm aware of that larger places, be they urban centres, priority communities, or territory growth towns, as if names generate growth, provide better prospects than evident at the 1,000 smaller places, except perhaps in the imagination of politicians and policy makers. Some of the focus on urbanisation might just be the state seeing like a state, to use James Scott's term. After all, Good state making requires the civilisation of space and demography. The state project is to homogenise communities and discourage small dispersed settlements and mobile populations that are hard and expensive to govern. Remote Indigenous communities are a post-colonial phenomenon, and the smallest and most numerous homelands or outstations are born from a rejection of state rule and development failure at centralised communities. Such communities provide opportunity for alternative life worlds and livelihoods, but the state looks to eliminate non-state spaces and to meet the labour and resource needs of mature capitalism, while those residing in homelands and outstations have become expert in state evasion, in not being governed. So part of the tension between Australian neoliberalism and small dispersed populations can be understood in such structural terms. There is, however, something far more insidious and ideological happening. And this is a time when the state discourse espouses ideology-free policy-making based only on evidence. If in 2001 I recognised early signs of an approach encompassing the authoritarian moralism of the neoliberal state, to use Luak Wakwant's term, this has gained momentum in the 21st century to transcend the dichotomous progressive-conservative debate to become a core element of the workings of the neoliberal state. I do not want to go into great detail about the lineage of this fundamental shift in thinking. It is born of many things. I note just four. First, a discourse of failure espoused by the media and elements of the Howard government for over a decade, linking the crisis of Indigenous violence to economic marginalisation, arguably aided, not abated by state neglect. Second, aspects of Aboriginal culture that have mixed badly with this neglect and have generated a destructive cocktail in some circumstances, now openly highlighted by some like Noel Pearson and Peter Sutton as an element of the so-called end of the permissive so-called liberal consensus. Third, the excessive influence of neoconservative thinkers like Helen Hughes, importing American punishing the poor and, in Australia's case, the different paternalistic policy approaches and ascribing to neoliberal principles that seek to encompass all in the realm of the free market. And finally, exacerbated right-hand or hard elements of the bureaucratic field, as in my first vignette, closely linked to Chicago school thinking, keen to find market-based technical solutions to both respond to and please and simultaneously influence political thinking while ostensibly delivering solutions to complex, deeply entrenched and diverse development problems. In the post-apology policy era and during an interregnum when there is no national Indigenous representative organisation, the Rudd government, through COAG, has colluded with the states and territories to develop the National Indigenous Reform Agreement, closing the gap. NERA, as it's known, is highly ideological and is based on neoliberal logics of economic deregulation, welfare state retreat, and a cultural trope of individual responsibility, while at the same time appearing to lock in billions of dollars of public funding for a decade for Indigenous advancement through a series of national partnership agreements. Much of NERA is focused on remote Australia, although in the latest COAG communique in July this year, there was belated recognition that closing the gap might need to include non-remote Australia, where 75% of Indigenous Australians live. From the perspective of remote communities, NERA is very worrying for a number of reasons. First, NERA articulates principles to incorporate those in remote locations into mainstream education and training and the market economy, and to promote personal responsibility and behaviours consistent with positive social norms. The aim is to encourage residents of small communities to migrate up the settlement hierarchy, where to-be-delivered education and job opportunities exist for an imagined gaps-free future. Nicholas Biddle from CAPER uses census data to show that this is sheer fantasy. Perhaps the state project of improvement requires the destruction of remote Aboriginal societies whose very existence challenges the neoliberal paradigm. Second, NERA renders complex development problems technical, to use James Ferguson's evocative term, both in financial and outcome terms. Debates about people are becoming increasingly abstract and statistical and avoid reference either to history or to lived reality. For example, in NERA, straight-line trajectories for all closing-the-gap targets are provided to indicate precise progress year in, year out, in improving people's lives. In the abstract, it is noted in NERA that such indicative trajectories are modelled from census and survey data, and while considered reliable, they do contain potential sources of error, including random sampling and or non-sampling errors. Such qualifications will provide little solace for the subjects of improvement if targets are missed. And third, the COAG agreements lock in resources for a decade, skewing them away from those who may be in greatest need just because they live in small communities. NERA is about picking a handful of development winners, and it is a risky strategy for Indigenous people in remote Australia. The latest government reporting on progress, measure by measure, for its massive Northern Territory Emergency Response intervention, now renamed Closing the Gap in the Northern Territory, very quietly posted on the FACSIA website on 22nd October this year, indicates worrying lack of progress at 73 prescribed remote communities. Let me turn now to the issue of getting political and targeting some spheres for some influence. Despite the failure of the dominant development paradigm to deliver results for remote Indigenous Australia, there is an ongoing discursive, ideological, and even intellectual commitment to this form of development, the modernisation paradigm. To try and counter this hegemonic neoliberal approach, I've used the hybrid economy framework to try and influence policy thinking about development alternatives for people living culturally and geographically beyond the mainstream. I want to draw here on just two cases encompassed by the hybrid economy model: engagement with mining, or with the market, as per my first vignette, and employment under the Working on Country program on Indigenous protected areas, where the market, state, and customer intersect, as per my third vignette. These cases are linked to two quite different ARC projects, one on Indigenous Australians and mining, in which I've been involved, that has recently been completed, and the other on people on country and natural resource management, that is ongoing. Mining has been touted as providing employment opportunity for Aboriginal people living remotely for decades, but in most situations it has been remarkably unsuccessful. In the 2006 census, for example, 176 Aboriginal people throughout the Northern Territory were employed in mining, despite major mines being located on Aboriginal-owned land adjacent to communities. Such employment failure is not everywhere, but it might represent an enduring manifestation of what Bill Stanner over 50 years ago termed an incompatibility between the dreaming, connections to a sentient landscape, and the market, industrial mining, as articulated by Mundaka Marika in my vignette 2. One of the obvious structural paradoxes at the heart of problematic relations between miners and landowners is that relations of opposition to mining need to somehow magically transform to relations of cooperation and collaboration once a deal is struck, as if there is no history of political conflict. Monolithic mantras of closing the gap from politicians like Jenny Macklin, or jobs, jobs, jobs from mining magnates like Andrew Twiggy Forrest, and escalating discursive pressures from both quarters will not resolve such political problems. However, mining can be a part of development for remote Indigenous communities if politicians and mining magnates can think a little bit more creatively. Some major corporations like Rio Tinto, eager to gain license to operate, are beginning to recognise economic hybridity and to countenance benefit-sharing agreements that will support diverse Indigenous aspirations to live on country, or to engage in customary activities like hunting, or to participate in natural resource management on and off mine sites, without simultaneously precluding mine site opportunity. In short, there's a recognition that people might orbit around the hybrid economy, with one of the stops, spatially or temporally, being mine site employment. The other case is linked to the emergence over the past decade of an Indigenous community-based grassroots caring for country movement that is seeing the use of Indigenous and local knowledge in the paid provision of a range of environmental services. In 2006, 400 Aboriginal people were employed as rangers just in the top part of the Northern Territory. The Indigenous estate that remained unalienated in the past, mainly because it had no commercial value, today includes some of the most biodiverse lands in Australia. But these lands are at risk of species contraction and face major threats from feral animals, exotic weeds, changed fire regimes, and pollution. In the face of this, there's been growing support from environmental agencies for Indigenous community-based efforts to ameliorate threats and minimise adverse biodiversity outcomes. Since 1997, 33 Indigenous protected areas have been declared over 230,000 square kilometres of Aboriginal-owned land. In 2007, a working on country program was established to pay proper wages to Indigenous rangers. Figure 3, my last figure, shows the location of declared Indigenous protected areas. There's a high correlation between IPAs and people on their living on their land at small remote communities. There is a lot that can be said about the second case, but I will limit myself here to just a few observations. On Indigenous protected areas, land and native title rights have facilitated the maintenance of hybrid economies and the emergence of a version of what Komarov and Komarov have termed ethnicity inc., the dialectical relationship between the legal corporatisation of identity in Indigenous protected areas and the modification of culture in the provision of environmental services. Like Komarov and Komarov, I do not seek to present ethnicity inc. as unproblematic, but is proving an exemplar of intercultural production. This is happening for many reasons. Rangers can work simultaneously in the customary state and market sectors, in segment 7 in the hybrid economy model. This represents a form of bliss point where people are paid to provide environmental services, but can also engage in customary activity, meeting individual needs and broader family obligations. Rangers confidently deploy Indigenous and local knowledge in their work on land and sea, but its success is largely enabled by Western technology, increasingly through the use of Cyber Tracker. The use of Cyber Tracker provides proof that environmental services are being delivered, as well as allowing rangers to work unsupervised on country and yet remaining highly accountable for whereabouts and outcomes. This suits both state and environmental agencies and other corporate and philanthropic sponsors. The politics of the hybrid economy project aims to empirically demonstrate sectoral overlaps and intersections that can be used by Indigenous interests to advance arguments for more equitable access to resources in the quest for substantive, not statistical, equality. I'm not suggesting that there are any easy development solutions to complex problems in difficult circumstances, but there is growing evidence that a suite of activities might make a livelihoods difference. I've recently used the hybrid economy framework alongside Aboriginal ownership of lands and seas to demonstrate a need to recognise customary and commercial rights over resources, in areas as diverse as climate change, carbon economy, property rights and water, the arts industry, wildlife harvesting and northern development. The hybrid economy framework can be used to alter the visioning of economic futures for Aboriginal people living on the expansive Indigenous estate. Let me just make a few concluding comments under the subtitle Choice Matters. I've no illusions that hybrid economy thinking is currently subordinate to the very dominant discourse of mainstreaming and engagement in the real economy. I also have little doubt that national and global uncertainties, combined with Indigenous aspirations and agency and massive land holdings, make the diversity of the hybrid economy a less risky and more optimistic option than the imagined economic integration of remote living Aboriginal people into the mainstream. Making inroads into the dominant discourse of normalisation endorsed by all Australian governments will not be easy, but I'm unwilling to stand by and let a hegemonic neoliberal view of Aboriginal futures that forecloses rather than allows Indigenous choice to reign either uncontested or supreme. I'm often challenged on the question of whether the hybrid economy model that I promulgate has applicability beyond the tropical north, where most of my research is focused. I've chosen here to illustrate the hybrid economy as a political project in the context of the states of the neoliberal state's policy assault on small, remote communities. This conference, though, is about Indigenous participation in Australian economies more broadly. I suspect that no paper will tell us about a seamless Aboriginal integration into the mainstream, although I'm always open to being surprised. Instead, we're likely to hear throughout the day about the complex triangulated relations between Indigenous Australians, the market, and the state, in which economic plurality and cultural diversity will loom large. Scholarly analyses will likely result in complexity being properly complicated rather than being absurdly simplified into any false binary, like modern or primitive, metropolitan or remote, white or black, market or customary, individual or group. The challenge we all face is getting beyond the dominance of a discourse that focuses only on capitalist economy and statistics, so we can reintegrate people and different cultural systems into analyses and interpretations. I'm not suggesting here that all scholars have to be political, but I am warning that we must be aware of our research, of how our research might be used in public and policy discourse, something I tried to demonstrate last year at the Australian Anthropological Society conference with reference to the co-option of the term demand sharing to justify racially based income quarantining. The vignettes with which I began encapsulate in part how the neoliberal state is not responding to Aboriginal aspirations and desires, often glossed in the economic realm by the word development. Instead, the project of improvement, to use Tanya Murray Lee's term, is looking to reshape Aboriginal values, beliefs, social relations and practices that remain distinct from mainstream norms. This project is not new in the remote Australian context. It revisits earlier failed attempts to shape Aboriginal subjectivities, to sedentarise, to civilise, normalise, to develop Aboriginal people, to transform them into subjects of the global project of modernity, to become responsible citizens of a multicultural liberal democratic state, to be hard-working labourers or profit-driven entrepreneurs in a free market, to be capitalist consumers of mass culture. To end on a more optimistic note, though, I turn to Wiquant's reading of Pierre Bourdieu and his proposition that the state cannot be construed as monolithic, but rather as a splintered space of forces vying over the definition and distribution of public goods in what he terms the bureaucratic field. Today, the bureaucratic field is locked in a struggle between what Bourdieu identifies as the right hand and left hand of the state. In my analysis today, the dominant right hand is represented in vignette one by the Department of Employment, Education and Workplace Relations and FACSIA, the left in vignette three by the Department of Environment. Perhaps there is hope in collaborative relations between elements of the bureaucratic field and some Aboriginal groups in remote Australia, and some emerging cracks in the bureaucratic field. I would like to end with a brief quote from the poem Anthem by Leonard Cohen. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Thank you.
John, do you want to field the question too? We've got
We've got 5 minutes or so for a question or two or comment or two. And would you please take the mic and identify yourself? So, any questions or comments?
I didn't attend the AIS conference last year. Could you just amplify a little bit on that? Was it a justification of income quarantining based on the taking of the term demand sharing?
My paper really just looked at the connection between what anthropologists had increasingly written about demand sharing and how this term, which was initially couched in a particular theoretical way by Nick Peterson, who's with us today, had been more and more loosely adopted by the other anthropologists, and then how politicians and bureaucrats had co-opted the term to refer to one negative way that Indigenous people were seen to share resources, particularly in relation to demands for money to purchase alcohol. So really what I was alluding to at the AAS was how this term that had a particular technical meaning in anthropological circles had become increasingly used in public discourse to justify controlling people's incomes. And interestingly, just having another stoush on New Matilda with Bob Dernan, who continues to use this term and has responded very negatively to my suggestion that he might want to go back and read Nick's original article again before he continues to use it.
Thanks, John. I'm just wondering if you could maybe spend a little bit of time to explain about the cyber tracking. I didn't quite follow that, particularly with the Ranger program. Thanks.
Sure. Cyber tracking are small handheld computers, and Aboriginal rangers have become quite expert at using these handheld computers to record the activities they undertake. This is done through your remote sensing GPS type technology. So, for instance, when rangers are undertaking sea patrols, they continually track where they're travelling, and they're also able to record the activities they undertake. For instance, if they locate an illegal fishing vessel, they can record that on their cyber tracker. If they find a piece of marine debris, they can record that on their cyber tracker. And what you get is very precise information on what people are doing. Similarly, when people undertake a fire management activity, every time they drop an incendiary, they actually record on a cyber tracker that they've started a fire. So you actually get these extraordinarily tracks across the landscape that capture the activities that people undertake. Now, this means that using cyber tracker, Aboriginal rangers can be out on country undertaking all sorts of activities that are actually recorded by satellites. So they don't need to be supervised, and also the outcomes from their activities can be pretty well monitored. So there's no, you know, questioning, you know, that these rangers are just jumping in a truck, going off into the bush and shooting a kangaroo and sitting around eating it. There's actually records of the activities they undertake. But as part of that activity, they also do shoot a kangaroo and eat it, and they also catch fish and eat them. So that's where you get sort of cyber tracking, you know, making, you know, the Caring for Country project coordinators, the state that supports these projects, and at times, you know, philanthropies and environmental NGOs are quite comfortable that their investments in these activities are actually generating positive outcomes.
Yeah, John, just keeping on that same track there, I understand that with the carbon credit scheme, that is, it's envisaged that native title holders won't be in a position to actually engage in those carbon credit trading schemes if they eventually become instituted, which seems to me to take away a large part of the kind of platform for economic sustainability in through the land management programs. Is that still the case as far as you're aware?
Not necessarily. I think that the you know, the standout and I think only a carbon abatement scheme in Australia at the moment is the West Arnhem Land Fire Abatement Project, where Aboriginal traditional owners are paid by ConocoPhillips for 100,000 tonnes of carbon that they abate per annum. But this is done outside the Kyoto Protocol framework. I think that post-Copenhagen, there needs to be a debate about who holds the property rights in carbon abated. Now, there's no doubt that Indigenous groups had disputation with the Australian Greenhouse Office earlier this decade in terms of property rights and carbon. But it seems to me highly likely that landowners who engage in fire abatement projects on their land using Indigenous knowledge and gaining permission from traditional owners will be in a very strong position to argue that they should hold, if not exclusive, certainly a significant property right in any carbon abated. So I certainly wouldn't be pessimistic about that, because as in so many of these issues where you get disputation over property rights, if you get an inconsistency, if you like, between customary and commercial rights, it places traditional owners in a very strong position to argue for a stake in property. In other words, if native title holders are precluded from property rights and carbon, there is nothing to stop them burning all their country at the wrong time, and so actually undermining the state's efforts to abate carbon. Now, I'm not saying that they would do that, but that customary right gives them enormous leverage in terms of arguing for, if not exclusive, certainly significant property rights and new forms of property. And that extends not just to carbon, but also to property rights in water, in fresh water, and also potentially property rights in biodiversity credits if that sort of scheme eventually comes about.
Well, I'd just like to thank John for a very stimulating keynote lecture. Thank you very much. Got us off to a terrific start.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.